For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today we have a history special. We'll hear some books about the sinking of the Titanic. We'll hear about Great Britain's Great War with Jeremy Paxman. We'll hear about the importance of preserving audio in all its forms. But first on today's show, let's hear about the history of RNIB itself. The charity started life in the home of Thomas Rhodes Armitage as the British and Foreign Society for improving the embossed literature of the blind, and later the British and Foreign Blind Association for promoting the education and employment of the blind. Thomas Rhodes Armitage trained as a doctor, retiring in the 1850s due to failing sight. He formed the British and Foreign Society in 1868, later attacking the utter confusion produced by a babel of systems for reading embossed type. He documented this process in his book, The Education and Employment of the Blind, What It Has Been, Is, and Ought to Be, which he wrote in 1871.
The object of the present work is to put together in an accessible and condensed form some of the more important facts relating to the education and employment of the blind. It has hitherto been extremely difficult for those interested in this subject to ascertain what is being done at the different schools in this and foreign countries, and there has been a total absence of any organised investigation undertaken by men who have made the education of the blind their special study. It seems self-evident that the proper persons to decide upon the best methods of instruction by touch are those who have to rely upon this sense, the blind themselves, and that those among the blind should be entrusted with this work who, from their education and antecedents, may be expected to approach so important a question with the requisite preliminary knowledge.
Although this wasn't reflected in a name change until 2002, from the very beginning, the institution wasn't for the blind, it was of the blind, being led from the start by people with sight loss.
A good education is of extreme importance to the blind, as by its aid many will succeed in life who without it would have been helpless, unhappy, and a burden to their friends or to society. Consequently, the elementary processes by which this education is to be brought about deserve the most careful investigation. Uniformity in the alphabet used by the blind has long been desired by all. But as each system has its own uncompromising advocates, we are still far from so desirable a result. The blind have, however, now taken matters into their own hands, and the closer union between those of different countries is already bringing about the happiest results in disseminating information, cheapening and improving educational apparatus, and raising the standard of education, and with it, the happiness and well-being of the blind throughout the civilised world.
Armitage doesn't talk much about his own life in the book, except this passage where he laments the end of his medical career, but accepts that his new role could prove much more useful to the blind and partially sighted community.
For about 10 years, gradually increasing loss of sight has incapacitated me from following my profession. And though this does not amount to blindness, it is sufficient to preclude the possibility of reading by sight. In judging, therefore, of the merits of the various means of education used by the blind, I must depend upon the sense of touch. And, acting in concert with the other members of the Executive Council of the Association, who are all totally blind, I have had the advantage of the constant cooperation of 5 highly educated blind gentlemen who, for the most part, like myself, are familiar with every system of embossed printing which has obtained currency among the blind. The belief that I have been able to take my share in this great work has gone far to reconcile me to the abandonment of my profession, to the scientific prosecution of which I had hoped to devote my life. But the very defect of sight, which proved an insuperable obstacle in the career which I had chalked out for myself, has peculiarly fitted me for a new and more extended sphere of usefulness. And I feel sure that if educated blind men only knew what happiness is to be derived from devoting their lives to a useful work for which their very blindness specially qualifies them, there would be no lack of intelligent workers.
Thomas Rhodes Armitage documents some of the many methods of reading that were available before it was realised that letters and symbols on paper could be raised up.
Various attempts have been made from time to time to enable the blind to read by touch. Some of these were extremely ingenious, such as the adaptation of the string records of Peru, in which different forms of knots made on a string stand for different letters, and the blind man was able to read by running the string through his fingers. But since Monsieur Oye's happy idea of printing in relief on paper, all other methods have only an antiquarian interest. In 1784, Monsieur Valentin Oye commenced the first printing in raised characters for the blind and founded the Institut des Jeunes Aveugles, which was the first and is still the best managed and finest blind school in the world. The character he chose was the italic, or written form, of the Roman letter. Braille's invention was only an improvement, though a very great one, on a previously existing writing frame introduced by Monsieur Barbier in 1820. Barbier's frame was, in principle, the same as Braille's, but his full number of dots was 12 instead of 6, so that his letters were unwieldy and the space covered by them inconveniently large. Braille first soldered strips of metal across Barbier's frame, by which means he obtained the power of writing his own more compact alphabet, and afterwards arrived at the form of frame which is still used and bears his name.
The problem was that any given generous benefactor who wanted to help the blind would not invest in an existing system to read and write by touch, but instead invent their own, leading to a number of conflicting systems and no clear method. So the society Rhodes founded began to research the effectiveness of different European and American-raised alphabets for both reading and writing. In 1870, after interviewing many blind people, the group detailed the advantages of the dotted systems being used throughout America and Europe, and therefore endorsed Braille. There was a long argument for using embossed letters, and indeed that system still exists in the Moon alphabet, although it is seldom used. The Roman alphabet would have been what the gentlemen of the society, having lost sight later in life, were taught in school and had a certain familiarity with, but in the end, Braille was decided as the preferred method.
In England, we have facilities such as do not exist in any other country of ascertaining the relative merits of different systems of raised characters. For in consequence of the numerous methods in use, those among the blind who value reading most are generally acquainted with several. They are thus in a position to judge which of them is the best suited to the purpose of reading by touch. In spite of the strongest prima facie reasons to the contrary, the unanimous decision was come to that the Roman character in all its existing forms is so complicated that it requires long education and great acuteness of touch to read it with ease, and that its universal adoption would be tantamount to the total exclusion of the great majority of the blind from the privilege of reading.
As forward-thinking as Armitage was, the book is still a product of its time, which is reflected in the following list of jobs.
Much public interest has for many years been directed to the best means of employment for the blind. Institutions have sprung up in every part of the country with the praiseworthy object of enabling the blind to support themselves by their own labour, and the good example set by England in this respect is being followed by other countries. The principal trades practiced in the United Kingdom by the blind are the making of baskets, brushes, brooms, mattresses, rugs, mats, the caning of chairs, with knitting and sewing for women. Music is also taught in many institutions, and piano tuning in a few. But neither of these are pursued with the amount of vigour and ability which is necessary to ensure the success which has been attained in other countries. It is difficult to estimate correctly the average earnings of the blind at trades, as so much depends upon the external circumstances in which they happen to be placed. Probably the average is not more than 5 or 6 shillings per week for men and less for women. But the present object is to compare the earnings at manual trades with those which may be obtained by piano tuning and the profession of music. Those workers, therefore, only should be considered who, with the requisite musical talent and instruction, might have become good tuners or teachers of music. Industry, good common sense, and manual dexterity are therefore presupposed. Such men at a trade can probably earn upon an average from about 8 to 12 shillings a week.
Armitage was very keen that British blind institutions become musical schools and train generations of blind piano tuners.
During the first years, the same difficulties and prejudices had to be encountered. But by degrees, makers and the general public grew accustomed to blind tuners, and the obstacles thrown in their way became daily less. Some makers, indeed, made a practice of always sending blind tuners to those among their customers who were most particular. And as the instruction at the institution was kept up to a high standard of excellence, and care was always taken to give a certificate of tuning to those only who were really masters of their art, the blind became more and more popular as tuners. The blind and their friends became every year more alive to the fact that tuning was the best and most remunerative employment they could follow.
Much of the book is made up of diagrams of Braille alphabets and musical notation. And with the now universal adoption of Braille as the way of writing and reading for blind and partially sighted people, the book ends on a positive note.
Now that the Braille system of writing is being generally adopted, much better training can be effected than was formerly possible. For the children can write out their exercises at home and bring them to school, so that the master not only knows what is being done during school hours, but also what amount of preparation has been made at home. And the pupil becomes accustomed to work for himself, which is the first step towards a useful education.
Armitage worked tirelessly for the adoption of Braille and succeeded. And in 1871, he helped establish the Royal Normal College for the Blind, which later became the Royal National College for the Blind in London. He also followed the pupils after school. In 1887, he helped found the Guild of Past Students, for, in quotes, the purpose of mutual aid, especially in the first entry into life. The Guild is still going strong today, as is the British and Foreign Society for Improving the Embossed Literature of the Blind, although you might know it as RNIB. Recently on Talking Books, we played the classic A Night to Remember, a chronicle of the sinking of the Titanic, by Walter Lord. It's read by Maurice Turner.
Far foreign, away from the uproar, trimmer Samuel Hemming climbed back into his bunk, satisfied that the hissing sound in the forepeak didn't mean very much. He was just drifting off to sleep when the ship's joiner leaned in, saying, "If I were you, I'd turn out. She's making water, 1, 2, 3, and the racket course getting filled up." An instant later, the bosun appeared. "Turn out, you fellas. We haven't half an hour to live. That's for Mr. Andrews. And keep it to yourselves and let no one know." Certainly no one knew in the first-class smoking room. The bridge game was going full blast again. Lieutenant Stephenson was still sipping his hot lemonade. And another hand was being dealt, when a ship's officer suddenly appeared at the door. "Men, get on your lifebelts. There's trouble ahead." In her A-deck stateroom, Mrs. Washington Dodge lay in her bed, waiting for Dr. Dodge, assessor for San Francisco, to dig up some news. The door opened, and the doctor came in quietly. Ruth, the accident's rather a serious one. You'd better come on deck at once.
Boris Turner reading from A Night to Remember by Walter Lord. And after listening to that book, I went to the RNIB library to see just how many Titanic books there were. My Story, An Edwardian Girl's Diary, 1912, Titanic, by Ellen Emerson White. Margaret Ann dreams of leaving the orphanage behind, and she can hardly believe her luck when she's chosen to accompany wealthy Mrs. Carstairs aboard the Great Titanic. But when passengers are woken on a freezing night in April 1912, she finds herself caught up in an unimaginable nightmare.
I have just returned, after shrugging on Father's wool coat as a dressing gown and slipping into my button boots. People were walking by on their way to the deck to see if perhaps we had struck another ship. Others feel that we may have grazed an iceberg, as the weather is so cold tonight. I knocked on Mrs. Carstairs' door, but she told me she was trying to sleep, and I should do the same, as any sensible person would do at this hour. I am, however, inclined to get dressed and go up to the deck to examine the situation for myself. I know he is busy, but I am even tempted to go and find Robert and ask him if... Wait, something is different. I am not sure what, but everything seems different. There has been a change in the atmosphere that I cannot quite distinguish. My ears feel a little hollow, and that is the difference. I can no longer hear the soothing, constant vibration of the engines. Over the past few days, that has become a comforting background noise, and now, just like that, it is gone. I wonder why. Voices out in the hall keep saying the word iceberg, but no one seems upset. Maybe this sort of event is routine in ocean travel. It seems odd that the engines would stop, so I hope they are not damaged in any way. Maybe they are just running more slowly, which is why I can no longer hear them. I think I will go out and find Robert now, since I know that he will relieve my curiosity. This must be routine. What else could it be?
My Story, Titanic, by Ellen Emerson White, is narrated by Rachel Louise Miller. Titanic, A Survivor's Story, by Archibald Gracie. And read by Jonathan Oliver. A first-hand account of the Titanic disaster, this book records not only the author's own experiences on that fateful night, but those of many other survivors. The author also attended numerous court hearings to obtain the official record.
During my short absence in conducting the ladies to a position of safety, Mr. Thayer and Mr. Widener had disappeared, but I know not whither. Mr. Widener's son Harry was probably with them, but Mr. Thayer supposed that his young son, Jack, had left the ship in the same boat with his mother. Monsieur Thayer and Widener must have gone toward the stern during the short interval of my absence. No one at this point had jumped into the sea. If there had been any, both Clinch Smith and I would have known it. After the water struck the bridge forward, there were many who rushed aft, climbed over the rail, and jumped. But I never saw one of them. I was now working with the crew at the davits on the starboard side forward, adjusting them, ready for lowering the Engelhart boat from the roof of the officer's house to the boat deck below. Someone of the crew on the roof, where it was, sang out, "Has any passenger a knife?" I took mine out of my pocket and tossed it to him, saying, "Here is a small penknife, if that will do any good." It appeared to me then that there was more trouble than there ought to have been in removing the canvas cover and cutting the boat loose, and that some means should have been available for doing this without any delay. Meantime, four or five long oars were placed aslant against the wall of the officer's house to break the fall of the boat, which was pushed from the roof and slipped with a crash down onto the boat deck, smashing several of the oars. Clinch Smith and I scurried out of the way and stood leaning with our backs against the rail, watching this procedure and feeling anxious lest the boat might have been stove in, or otherwise injured so as to cause it to leak in the water. The account of the junior Marconi operator, Harold S. Bride, supplements mine. "I saw a collapsible boat," he said, "near a funnel, and went over to it. 12 men were trying to boost it down to the boat deck. They were having an awful time. It was the last boat left. I looked at it longingly a few minutes, then I gave a hand, and over she went."
Titanic, a survivor story by Archibald Gracie, is read by Jonathan Oliver. Clive Cussler's Raise the Titanic. Mightiest of ocean liners, the Titanic lies 2.5 miles down in the North Atlantic, and in her hold, perhaps the only amount anywhere of an incredibly rare substance that could make the free world invulnerable to foreign attack forever. The Americans want it, and so do the Russians. And the sea never gives up its secrets without a struggle, which makes the task facing ace maritime troubleshooter Dirk Pitt one of the most stupendous tests of human courage and ingenuity ever.
Suddenly, in the gloom at the outer edge of the blackness, a rounded object became visible, haloed in the eerie light like an immense tombstone. Soon the three pairs of eyes inside the submersible could distinguish the furnace gratings of the great boiler, and then the row upon row of rivets along the iron seams and the torn, jagged tentacles of what was left of its steam tubing. "How would you like to have been a stoker in those days and fed that baby?" Giordino muttered. "I've picked up another one," Gunn said. "No, wait. The pulse is getting stronger. Here comes the length. 100 feet... 2. Keep coming, sweetheart," Pitt prayed. 500, 700, 800 feet. We got her. We've got her." "What course?" Pitt's mouth was as dry as sand. "Bearing 097, Gunn replied in a whisper. They spoke no more for the next few minutes as the sea slug closed the distance. Their faces were pale and strained with anticipation. Pitt's heart was pounding painfully in his chest, and his stomach felt as if it had a great iron weight in it, and a huge hand crushing it from the outside. He became aware that he was allowing the submersible to creep too close to the ooze. He pulled back the controls and kept his eyes trained through the viewport. What would they find? A rusty old hulk, far beyond hope of salvaging? A shattered, broken hull buried to its superstructure in the muck? And then his straining eyes caught sight of a massive shadow looming up ominously in the darkness. "Christ almighty," Giordino mumbled in awe. "We've struck her fair on the bows." As the range narrowed to 50 feet, Pitt slowed the motors and turned the sea slug on a parallel course with the ill-fated liner's waterline. The mere size of the wreck when viewed from alongside her steel plates was a staggering sight. Even after nearly 80 years, the sunken ship proved to be surprisingly free of corrosion. The gold band that encompassed the 882-foot black hull glistened under the high-intensity lights. Pitt eased the submersible upward past the 8-ton portside anchor until they could all clearly make out the 3-foot-high golden letters that still proudly proclaimed her as the Titanic.
Raise the Titanic by Clive Cussler is read by Michael Fitzpatrick. Also available are Titanic Lives, The Discovery of the Titanic, The Titanic Disaster, Titanic's Last Secrets, and The Riddle of the Titanic, in which the authors present a reassessment of one of the greatest legends of the 20th century. They show that the discovery of the wreck has raised more problems than it solved. They also bring out other intriguing questions. Why was the man at the helm when she hit the iceberg packed off to South Africa? Why did her chief officer feel uneasy about sailing on her? Why did one of the stewards wish the bally ship at the bottom of the sea? It wasn't only the sea that covered up the Titanic.
A framed notice behind glass in the chart room of every White Star liner drew the attention of officers to a series of principles, the first of which was the vital importance of exercising the utmost caution in navigation, safety outweighing every other consideration, the document's own emphasis. The ship's rules contain the following order. The chief officer is held jointly responsible with the commander for the safe and proper navigation of the steamer, and it shall be his duty to make a respectful representation to the commander if he apprehends danger when his responsibility shall cease. Any neglect in this respect will not be excused. There is no means of knowing whether Wilde made any representation to Smith. But if he was uneasy before the voyage began, indeed before he joined the ship, one cannot help wondering how he felt when he heard, as he must have done, of the specific ice warnings received as the liner pounded westward. The chief officer, who of course followed his captain in going down with the ship, is a curiously shadowy figure, seldom coming out of the background in the evidence of the two inquiries. But when he is mentioned by witnesses, he emerges as a powerful, calming presence, supervising the loading of the boats while quelling indiscipline and panic by sheer force of personality. Not the kind of man one would think to be overcome by queer feelings before taking up his berth on a ship where he could never previously have worked, the brand new Titanic. From Wilde's letter to his sister, it is absolutely clear that he felt unhappy about the ship before he took up his post, and that his misgivings were not dispelled when he boarded her for the first time, at any rate since she had been officially commissioned on the 2nd of April 1912. The unease of Henry Wilde is another of the tantalizing mysteries in the Titanic myth. Could he have seen or heard something that escaped the attention of others, with the possible exception of John Coffey? Or was this experienced, imposing man in his prime just a superstitious wimp? The Titanic started work with a fire burning in her bowels, no binoculars in her crow's nest, no lifeboats for half of those aboard, and an uneasy chief officer dragooned on board against his will on her bridge. He, the first officer, the chief engineer, and a large slice of the rest of the crew were veterans of the Olympic, as, of course, was the captain himself. The latter once again allowed his ship to go too fast in narrow waters, only just evading, thanks mostly to the skill of a tug-skipper, yet another mishap. Although the ship's coal problem was solved at the expense of other vessels, passengers were few, and a significant number cancelled at the 11th hour. The official inspections were perfunctory, and the owner's chief representative held a secret conclave with the chief engineer to plan a speed test, and then kept a vital ice warning in his pocket for 5.5 hours. Neither he, nor the master, nor the officers, nor indeed the generality of the merchant marine, apparently felt any special caution was necessary, although all of them knew, in a general sense, before they set sail, that the great ship was heading for an extremely unusual, not to say unique, concentration of ice in an area where ice should not have been such a hazard on the main Atlantic liner route at that time of year.
The Riddle of the Titanic by Robin Gardner is read by Ronald Markham. A small selection of books about the Titanic disaster, available from RNIB Talking Books. For more information, head to the library, rniblibrary.com, or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. This is a Read On History special. Now, you may have seen the TV show presented by Jeremy Paxman, Britain's Great War, shown on BBC One with audio description. Well, the book that accompanies that show is now available from RNIB Talking Books.
The family never learned precisely what killed Uncle Charlie. Was he machine-gunned to death? Was he one of the thousands who'd been weakened by the dysentery and typhoid that quickly spread among the men, pinned down in disgusting conditions in the gullies below the enemy machine guns for days on end? The memory of some others who died there, bakers' sons from the Orkneys, gardeners and footmen from the Royal Estate at Sandringham, the almost 500 men of the Dublin Fusiliers, or the son of the Vicar of Deal who won the Victoria Cross for repeatedly wading ashore under fire to rescue wounded men from the beaches, has been kept more conscientiously alive. The deaths of over 11,000 Australian and New Zealand soldiers at Gallipoli are venerated as a sacred part of their nation's histories.
A clip of Jeremy Paxman reading the introduction to Great Britain's Great War, with the rest of the text being read by Roy McMillan. Jeremy Paxman told me why he decided to write the book.
Well, what had interested me for quite a long time is not so much the stories of the battles, I'm not a military historian, but the story of what this extraordinary conflict did to our country. I think that it changed more or less everything. I think if you were a Victorian time traveller and had come back in 1914, you would understand exactly how the country worked. But if you came back 10 years later, in 1924, after the war, you wouldn't have a clue.
Now, what actually came first? Was it the book or the TV show?
I wrote the synopsis for the book, and then I gave that to the television producers and to the publishers. And I sort of worked on the two simultaneously, really. I suppose the book came a bit first, except for some bits towards the end, when frankly, I fell rather behind.
Because I noticed the book's a lot more personal to you than the TV show was.
Is it?
Well, on a TV show, we didn't hear about your family, but that's how the actual book starts.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't think there's any... This is my great-uncle Charlie, who signed up in that rush of volunteers in the autumn of 1914. Possibly the spring of 1915. I think it was 1914. He was dead by August 1915. He was a private in the Royal Army Medical Corps. I don't suggest that there's anything unusual about that experience. I think every family had very often something very, very similar. I mean, there were something like 16,000 villages in England and Wales in 1918, and there were 40 of them to which all the men who had volunteered or been conscripted to serve returned at the end of the war. So this was a massive, massive casualty level. And I don't suggest there's anything unusual about the experience of my great-uncle Charlie beyond the fact that his photograph had hung on the wall when I was growing up. And I'm fascinated by the fact that this is an event which has passed now from family history, really, to the realms of pure history. And, frankly, a history that's very poorly understood.
I think my family was lucky because there's a tradition of shipbuilding in the family, which was a huge essential trade at the time.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, shipbuilding, various foundries, the munitions factories, the mines, all of these had groups of men who were exempt from military service, although when things got really tough in the spring of 1918, very large numbers of these men who were in what were called reserved occupations said, I know I'm exempt from military service, but I want to serve. There were lots of people who tried it on, of course, lots of people who thought, for example, there were tripe dressers in the northwest of England who appeared saying it's an essential trade. Women can't do this. I must therefore be exempt from military service. There was even a bloke in Leeds who tried to claim that he shouldn't do his military service now and until he completed his course of hair restoration.
Now, going back to the start of the war, and it's something that's been debated on TV at the moment, but was it a necessary war?
Well, I don't know. All wars are, in a sense, unnecessary, aren't they? Because they are the resolving of disputes by means other than the sensible way of resolving disputes, which is to argue things out and come to an agreement. So was it necessary? I think it was inevitable. I think that at some point, I know there are people now saying that it was a war we didn't need to get into, but I think at some point there would necessarily have come a conflict with Germany and probably the rest of Europe, as was to happen again with the Second World War. There was something about German militarism, German ambitions, German imperial dreams, I think. They felt hard done by comparison with Britain and France. I think sooner or later there was bound to be a conflict, yes.
What surprised me was the fact that there were protests for peace before war broke out, very much like the protests we had before the Iraq War.
Yes, there were. Bertrand Russell, for example, who was a prominent pacifist at the time, Bertrand Russell felt that he had suddenly lost contact with his country when he saw, in those early days in August 1914, he saw people running around, apparently enthusiastic about war. I slightly dispute that. I'm not sure they were enthusiastic about war so much as enthusiastic about something that was completely unknown to them. Nobody, of course, appreciated what the cost would be. And Bertrand Russell wandering around London was just astonished and appalled by what he saw, and felt that he just didn't understand Britain any longer.
Hmm.
But there were pacifists right from the start, yes.
You discussed the pacifists and also the conscientious objectors in the TV show. Now, why did you call them cranks?
I didn't call the conscientious objectors cranks. I said it has always seemed to me that the extreme conscientious objectors were cranks. That's not saying that all conscientious objectors were cranks. I'm saying, or what I said when I was asked by the producer, what do you really think of these people? And I said, well, I rather admire those who refuse to join in something because everyone else was doing it. I admire them for that. But the extreme ones who refused to have anything to do with the war strike me as being so eccentric that the word crank is merited. There were, for example, many Quakers who went and served in something called the Friends Ambulance Unit and were largely admired by soldiers because although they didn't fight, they were extremely brave in rescuing casualties and treating them. So, you know, and there were many other conscientious objectors who did vital war work, whether it was working in factories or working on the land. So, you know, there were many other ways of coming to the aid of a country in a situation, of course, it shouldn't have been in, perhaps.
Mm.
But just to refuse to do anything does strike me as an eccentric position.
Now, you looked at the movie The Battle of the Somme and talk about how it was a gamble that paid off, showing the public real images of the horror of war, galvanising the public behind the war effort. Now, why do you think subsequent images of war, say from the war in Vietnam, had the opposite effect?
I think there are a number of differences, of course. You're talking about images of the Vietnam War which helped consolidate a lot of anti-war opinion. Now, there was an anti-war opinion before much of that was seen. It was not a popular war, even from the start. It was very easily got into, the Vietnam War, and was very difficult to get out of. But people were experiencing those images of the war in their own homes, of course. They were seeing them via television, whereas cinema was a collective experience. This was silent cinema, of course, watched in picture houses, vast numbers of people, huge numbers of people, for the first 3 or 4 weeks of the screening of this film. People had never seen anything like this before, and they experienced it collectively. And I think perhaps that's part of the explanation. I don't know, I haven't, but I would guess that maybe has something to do with it.
And there was also a fear of invasion, and for the first time, almost civilians were also in danger during war.
Oh, indeed. I mean, the first trenches weren't dug in France or in Flanders. The first trenches were dug in southern England for fear of invasion. And there were civilian casualties right from the early days of the war, whether they were from shells fired from German naval ships, as happened up on the northeast coast, Scarborough, Whitby, Hartlepool, both Hartlepools, in December 1914. Subsequently, Zeppelins, big airships flying over the east coast cities, dropping bombs. And then, of course, by 1917, you get full-scale bombing raids, large numbers of German bombers coming over and dropping death out of the sky. So there were civilian casualties right throughout the war, of course, on a much smaller scale than in the army. But there were civilian casualties right from the start. And I think that it was understood very early on that it was a war that would involve everybody.
Mm. Now, you mentioned casualties, but some of the casualties from the front line, be it by mustard gas or be it by shell fragments or bullets, but there was an awful lot of sight loss and blindness caused by the war.
There was a tremendous amount of loss of eyes or damage to the eyes during the First World War. All sorts of areas of medicine made huge advances during this war. Of course, it would have been better had there not been a war. I'm not saying that. But there were, of necessity, huge strides made in medicine during the First World War. Take another example, not blindness, but amputation. If you look at the number of men who returned without legs or arms after the First World War, you will find the proportion goes down as the war goes on. The reason for that is that in the early stages of the war, it wasn't realised how much damage could be done by the contamination of the filth of the trenches. Once that was realised and new forms of antiseptic were developed and the need for what was called wound excision, which was to cut away any flesh that might be slightly contaminated, so you stopped gangrene setting in, then the number of amputations fell. Similar advances happened in plastic surgery and the reconstruction of faces, and there were many advances, I'm not familiar with the details, in the care of the eyes, the care and treatment of the eyes, but very large numbers of men were blinded. And one of the most moving images, of course, of the war is those poor blinded men after a gas attack, each man in single file with his hand on the shoulder of the man in front because they couldn't see where they were going.
Mm.
And, you know, these are the early days when you see at St. Dunstan's, which is still commemorated now on Armistice Sunday in November, you still see these old veterans from there. Not First World War veterans, obviously, but you still see that there is a great ongoing duty of care to men who have had their eyesight damaged or destroyed in war.
St. Dunstan's, of course, still provide that support, but under the new name of Blind Veterans UK. Now, that image you mentioned of the soldier standing in single file is on the wall of the RNIB Talking Book Studios for the simple reason that those soldiers returning from the front with no sight and perhaps losing some sensitivity in their fingertips, so Braille was really hard to learn, that's where the Talking Book service started.
I didn't know that.
Mm.
Thank you for telling
that
me.
That was the impetus of the Talking Book
I don't know about
service.
You, but I think that the whole point of life, what a ridiculous thing to say, but it's certainly what's always got me out of bed in the morning is curiosity, and I now feel I've learned something today, which is a lot better than it's been so far today.
Uncle Charlie must have made it clear when he signed up that his mother, Florina, was a widow, for the printed Sir with which the form begins has been scored out and replaced with a handwritten Madam. The impersonal tone resumes with the printed sentence, "It is my painful duty to inform you that a report has this day been received from the War Office notifying the death of," and here the Colonel in charge of Medical Corps Administration at Aldershot has inserted into the blank spaces Uncle Charlie's name, rank and number, adding, "Number 34 Field Ambulance of the Mediterranean Expeditionary Force," in the space left blank for his unit. "The cause of death was," and here an entire line of the form is left empty, which the Colonel has made no attempt to fill, just writing the single unilluminating word, "wounds."
A clip from Jeremy Paxman's Great Britain's Great War, which, of course, is available from RNIB Talking Books. And Jeremy, thank you so much for joining me today on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And finally, on this Read On History special.
If we see somebody we don't know, we say, "Aye, yes, him."
"Who's that?"
"Who's that? Aye, yes, him." Yeah.
A clip of Bobby and Gordon Hogg, the last two speakers of the Cromarty Fisher Folk dialect. And in a moment, we'll find out why this audio highlights the importance of looking after our audiovisual heritage, both in Scotland and in the UK as a whole, with the Save Our Sounds initiative at the British Library and in Scotland, Scotland Sounds. RNIB Talking Books have a recording history that stretches back over 80 years and includes a number of different formats. Books that were recorded onto wax disc were then distributed on brittle shellac and then later vinyl. The service then moved to both recording and delivery on tape of different sizes. Here's Ian Turner, a former manager of the RNIB Talking Book Studios.
In those days, we used to record on 1-inch tape, directly onto 1-inch tape, and that 1-inch tape was sent to the production unit in Alberton, where they made the cassettes. But then we moved to just up the road from Great Portland Street, original studios, and we moved about 50 yards up the road to new studios, and we recorded on 1/4-inch tape. Now, the difference it made meant that for the first time ever, we were able to have a copy, or a master copy of every single book we did. Prior to that, the 1-inch tape was the only recording we had of any book, and we were very lucky not to lose any of our recordings.
At the end of the 1990s, digital recording was brought in, and at the same time, the entire RNIB Talking Book library, on a number of formats, was re-archived.
We had something like 12,000 titles on our shelves. we couldn't possibly lose those. That was a huge archive. And so we worked on developing a process of transferring all of those books across to the digital system and then transferring them again into the DAISY structure. A huge task. And it also allowed us to look at what books we had, see if there was any gaps in the system, see if any books actually needed re-recording, see if any recordings were so poor that we had to re-record them again. I remember one, I won't tell you his name, but we had one gentleman who if he didn't like the way he was recording, this was before my time, I hasten to add, if he didn't like what he was recording, he used to change it to suit his own needs. Or if he didn't like one particular sentence, he used to cut that out as well. And those books we've reread. And I've got a much better version now.
RNIB are well aware of the value in archive audio, an awareness shared by UNESCO, as recently it was World Day for Audiovisual Heritage. And in a statement, they said, audiovisual documents such as films, radio and television programmes are our common heritage and contain the primary records of the 20th and 21st centuries. They help to maintain the cultural identity of a people, but countless documentary treasures have disappeared since the invention of image and sound technologies that permit the peoples of the world to better share their experiences, creativity and knowledge. And they add that all the world's audiovisual heritage is endangered. There are two main initiatives in the UK, Save Our Sounds at the British Library, and in Scotland, Scotland Sounds. I spoke to the sound curator of the National Library of Scotland, Alistair Bell, and asked how important this day was.
It's great that UNESCO have recognised that audiovisual heritage is so important. I mean, it's a type of heritage that is very much at risk. There's all sorts of different types of recordings, sound recordings specifically, that we work with. So they can be wax cylinders, they can be discs, so shellac discs, 78 recordings, up to vinyl disc, magnetic tape, open reels, cassettes, and right up to digital recordings. And the thing is that these types of recordings are all very much at risk from, well, degradation is one thing, but it's really more about the equipment and the skills and the knowledge to play these different types of recordings from all over the decades is actually quite scarce. And so having a day that recognises the risk to these audiovisual collections, these sound collections, but also thinking about the culture that comes from sound recordings and the fact that these recordings are recording parts of history that aren't recorded in other ways, either written down or in image. So I think the audiovisual heritage is very much at risk, but it also paints a very different type of picture over the 19th and 20th century that's well worth preserving.
For the lift, well, to start off with the story about the lift. In the 1950s, of course, there's no health and safety in those days, you know, and the lift only had one gate. And you could just go and open it, slide it open and get on the lift. And the parcel boy in the basement, he heard the lift go one day and he went up. There's nobody on the ground floor, nobody on the first floor, nobody in the second, nobody in the third. And one of the assistants looked up from the fourth floor on the third floor. There's a lady standing on top of the lift holding onto the cable. Of course, she disappeared by that time up to the fourth floor, so she ran up to the fourth floor. She's got a lady standing on top of the lift. I said, don't be ridiculous. So they wound this lift down and nothing like that had ever happened before, so they weren't sure what to say. But she said it for them. She was immaculately dressed in a fur coat and white gloves all covered with grease off the cable. She says, you keep your lifts in a filthy condition, I'm never coming back to the shop again, and walked off.
My role is very unique, I suppose, because I have an overview over the collections held at the National Library. So I work at the National Library of Scotland and look at the different sound collections that we hold here. And we have quite a range, so it's partly music, partly oral history, and partly other types of collections that have come in. But I also work as part of the Scotland Sounds Network, which is a kind of collaborative network that we've set up to create a kind of distributed and shared responsibility for improving the care and access to the sound collections. So we've got various different types of sound collections all over Scotland, oral history collections, interviews, poetry, music and song, environmental recordings, sound art as well. So there's a real breadth of different types of collections all over Scotland. And what my role as a sound curator is really to do is to try and help look after these collections better and make people feel better equipped who are looking after these collections with the skills and the knowledge that they might need to look after these types of specialist recordings, but also to try and interpret those and provide access for those in the public sphere so that they're much more accessible to as many people as possible.
This was in the days when the coal bunker was in front of the window in the tenement, you know. And I'm one hangers, this is curtains. One hangers, so Margaret says, what size? Edinburgh, Ken, do you know what size? And Margaret says, well, I won't know. She says, she says, I'm no too long away in the scheme to find out. She says, let me see, she says. The coal bunker's 4 feet high. My man's 6 feet high. And when he stands on the box, the curtain rail's 12 feet above his head, 12 feet. And that's how she measured her curtain. That's how she measured her curtains.
It's probably quite accurate.
Isn't that wonderful?
It's wonderful.
Thanks to the University of Dundee Archives. Ian Wilson and his daughter Diane talking to interviewer Rona Miller in June 2015, reminiscing about his store G.L. Wilson, or The Corner.
So you're basically saying to people who may have a recording like this on quarter-inch tape or on shellac or something like that, is as quickly as you possibly can, digitise that.
Absolutely. I mean, well, from an international recognition for archives, museums, libraries and other types of institutions that are used to caring for these types of collections, we have about a 15-year plan, really, to try and digitise as much as we can. And that's because these things are very much at risk. It might be that people have collections themselves, which they want to digitise and provide access to. But it might also be that people are thinking about the collection and the legacy and the long-term preservation of those items that they've recorded over the years, and thinking about who they want to look after that material. And it might be local museums, libraries and archives that they turn to do so.
For an empress she might pass, and the creel she trudges daily does, my bonny fisher lass.
What we've done is found some archival sound recordings from the School of Scottish Studies archive about fishing and fishing communities. And this just shows you kind of some of the value of audio archives and how they can be used to stir memories and also be used for enjoyment.
A storm arises, I'm down upon the pier, and stand and watch sincerely for his boat to appear.
The Bonny Fisher Lass song, recorded in Shetland in 1971 by Grace Anderson.
I'd wander broken hearted, said the Bonny Fisher Lass.
Has there been a case where a sound has been found or archived that's maybe quite trivial or appears to be quite trivial, but it suddenly became very important?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think so. There's a good example might be Ambala, for instance. Ambala is a website which is a kind of portal to the Highland life, so the museum, libraries and archives collections in the Highlands. And they have a recording of 2007 of two elderly gentlemen, brothers, just recorded in conversation. And it turns out that they were two of the last users of the Cromarty Fisher dialect. And they were happily just talking away to each other in this dialect. Now, since then, both gentlemen have passed away. And so now we have a recording of the Cromarty dialect in full flow. So there's still a few people maybe in the Black Isle and Cromarty that are able to say the occasional word. But here was the last two gentlemen that were able to do that in full flow. And so at the time of the recording, they probably felt it would be that important to record them. But, you know, since they've passed away, it's much more meaningful that we have this kind of final last record to understand what that dialect was like.
In Cromarty, there were at least two, anyway.
Two. I want to say there were three.
East of Toon and west of Toon, right?
Aye.
But over the years, you must remember this, since I was a boy, the whole language in Cromarty has changed completely. Once upon a time, you open your mouth, and you're from Cromarty.
Aye.
Nobody says that, you know. No.
Thanks once again to Ambala. Now, Alistair, tell us about the work you're doing with the British Library.
So there's a big campaign at the moment that the British Library are running, which is called Save Our Sounds. And this is really based on what I was talking about with the threat to these types of recordings, where we know that we've only got 15 years to transfer these into a digital format. You know, the future of sound recordings is digital. We're not going to be continuing to be able to bring out open reel tapes and 78 discs in future. Certainly wax cylinders are not the most accessible formats. So the future is digital. So the British Library are leading this project that's going to be for all around the UK to try and preserve the most at-risk materials in the UK, these sound recordings, and open them up and provide access to them online. So there's a big project that we're involved in that's on its way in this campaign to really save these collections at risk. So the British Library, if you check the website www.bal.uk and then look at projects and save our sounds, you'll be able to find out more about the British Library project. And if you want to know more about the Scotland Sounds Network, we are available on Twitter at Scotland Sounds. And feel free to tweet us and ask us any questions about how you can get involved in our network or find out more about what collections are available to you.
So if you have any audio, something you've had transcribed, or maybe an old talking newspaper on cassette, hang on to it, because it may become a heritage recording. You can browse and discover more fabulous archive recordings online at sounds.bl.uk. Google Save Our Sounds at the British Library. Head to ambala.org.uk, which is spelt A-M-B-A-I-L-E. You can head to tobarandokus.co.uk, which is spelt T-O-B-A-R-A-N-D-U-A-L-C-H-A-I-S.co.uk. And of course, for more information on the RNIB Talking Books Library, for brand new and for some heritage audiobook recordings, head to rnib.org.uk/books. Thanks for listening to this Read On History special. If you want to find me, I'm on Twitter at @talking_books. And this show is available as a podcast. Search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. See you next week.